How does your vote make a difference?
Stay on 702 and Cape Talk.
It's 13 minutes after 9 o'clock. We're trying to connect with Andrew Harding. While we do so, I want us to talk about... Are we good? Okay, it appears that Andrew Harding is now available. Andrew, I want to appreciate you so much for agreeing to talk to me this evening about your latest title, These Are Not Gentle People. Such brilliant reviews coming from all sorts of sources. The fact that you touch on so many South African issues... and you've managed to condense them in a story that touches on those issues in a way that is accessible to idiots, even such as myself. So congratulations on your win of the Sunday Times CNA Literary Award this year for nonfiction. And thank you once again for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you. That's far too kind of you, but I really appreciate it. It's a real pleasure to be on your show. And greetings from the Eastern Cape.
Indeed. Andrew, what are the facts of the story of what happened in that farm outside of Parys before we get into some of the nuances, the issues, the literary issues, what happened there?
Well, where to begin? So this started in early January 2016 when an alarm was raised by a group of white farmers out on the commercial farms outside Parys. There was a report that an elderly farmer had been attacked at his home at about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the local network of white farmers, many of them related to him, responded to the call and came rushing towards his house, believing that he'd been attacked, concerned about farm attacks, worried that he'd been perhaps fatally injured, and were immediately on the lookout for what they were told were two black men who'd launched this attack. And they pretty quickly found and arrested two black men in the corner of a field near Ludie van der Westhuizen's house. And then, over the course of the next few hours, they proceeded to assault those two men with extreme violence. And and taken into Parys.
I lost you there for a moment when you were speaking about the assault on these two men with extreme violence. Then you went quiet for a second. What did I miss?
I'm sorry about that. Yes, so they were violently assaulted. And the next morning, both men, having been taken away by the police in the back of a police car from the scene, in this corner of a field, were pronounced dead. And that set off this extraordinary years-long investigation and trial and traumas within this already divided community in Parys between black farm workers and within the white farming community as people turned on each other as the investigation grew more and more pointed and the hawks were brought in under, it seemed, pretty strong political pressure to solve what was, to many people, perceived as a race crime.
And is there any twist ultimately to who was guilty of the crime?
So 12 people were identified as having basically admitted that they'd assaulted these two men. Half of those, most of them all related, half of them ended up turning state witness. So they cut a deal with the prosecution that in return for their testimony against their own relatives, they would be let off. And so they testified against 5 of their relatives and friends and cousins and so on. And those people were all convicted of assault, but they were found not guilty of murder. The judge decided that because the men had been put in the back of a police van, and because that police van had then driven perhaps 100 meters over some fairly bumpy farmland, that might have actually constituted a new act, a new reason why these two men might have died, despite the fact that they were already unconscious because of the beatings, the prolonged beatings that they'd received from multiple farmers. This was considered a new act, and therefore she found that none of the accused could be found guilty of murder. And that's a finding that the prosecution are appealing, and they're also appealing against the sentencing, because in the end, none of the five men, two older men and three younger, much younger, farm sons and relatives, none of them were given custodial sentences. They were all given suspended sentences or some sort of vague kind of house arrest, which sentenced them to stay at home overnight, essentially.
The title of the book is These Are Not Gentle People. Why?
So for the longest time, you know, over the 5 years that I was researching and writing this, it was going to be called Crater's Edge, because the two men, Samuel and Simon, died on the rim, the fading rim of the old Vredefort Dome, this extraordinary remnants of what is probably the largest ever meteorite impact site the world has ever seen, or at least the world has ever discovered.
Yeah.
But towards the end of my research on the story, I sat with one of the key figures who'd really opened up to me and told me a great deal about what was going on in the farming community. And she used this phrase. She said, "These are not gentle people, Andrew." And she was talking about her neighbors. And it struck me as a very powerful and very ambiguous phrase that I knew would be picked up by people and interpreted in probably in racialized ways. You know, it's the black people, it's the white people, it's the farmers, it's the farm workers. And yet actually this was a much more complex, much more nuanced phrase that spoke above all about violence and about violence within families and about a culture of violence, particularly against women, actually. But in this case, of course, against two defenseless black men who'd already been arrested. And so I decided that that would make a good title, because I felt that it was ambiguous and complicated in all sorts of interesting ways. And there was something lyrical as well to me about it. Mm.
Did anybody ever find out who had launched the attack on the old man who raised the alarm bell that invited this vigilante group that ultimately killed these two men? Did anybody ever find that out?
The judge decided that there was no final conclusion, that didn't matter. So what happened was, yes, Simon Jubeba and Samuel Chicha, two black farm workers who knew all the farmers in the area and had worked on most of their farms, they did go to Ludi van der Westhuizen's house alone one afternoon, and they did have some sort of confrontation with him. There's no doubt about that. But the families of Simon and Samuel always said they had told us exactly what they were going to do. They were going to demand unpaid wages. It was early in the new year. They were broke. They were frustrated. They felt they'd been treated badly and kicked off their jobs by the farmers. So they went to old Ludi's to ask for money. And there was clearly an altercation. In fact, Ludi himself told the police that they tried to attack him with a broom. And what was always, I think, concerning for the prosecution was that here were two young, fit, strong men who'd gone to confront an elderly farmer at his house, and yet they'd ended up running for their lives across the fields, chased by men, and that no robbery had taken place. So had these men really gone to rob this old man, and had it suddenly gone terribly badly wrong? Or had they simply gone to ask for money they believed they were owed, and then when they realized that they weren't going to get that money, and that actually this man had pressed an alarm button, and suddenly all these farmers were going to chase them, had they just simply run away in a panic and then been caught and savagely beaten for something that they really hadn't done? And I have to say, that the answer to that question is still unclear. And I sometimes feel like I know the answer, and sometimes I really feel I don't.
The book is entitled These Are Not Gentle People, and I'm speaking to award-winning journalist, correspondent, and author of this particular book, Andrew Harding, recently won the Sunday Times CNA Literary Award for this work. And it is, I suppose, as you listen to his narration of the story, a very typically South African story. And I imagine that perhaps the people in the South of America, the American South, would probably find this to be a familiar story. I can't tell you, Andrew, how many times I have heard of this story, not specifically the one that you've written about, but as a child growing up, this was a typical story. This is what typically happened in our farming communities. I mean, that's what we grew up hearing about. So at one level, I'm glad that it finds expression through your pen, because it is a ubiquitous South African story, right? But I'm also a little bit underwhelmed, not at your work, right? I'm underwhelmed by the fact that this is such a big story for platforms such as the Sunday Times CNA Literary Award. Perhaps I should be more specific. The award is for the way that the story is told, and that. But I'm underwhelmed by the fact that South Africa seems to not know the ubiquity of the story. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I was pleased, selfishly as a writer, that I had this story almost completely to myself. Because although in the very early days and weeks after the assault and after Simon and Samuel's death, there was some media interest and there was some confrontation between far-right white farming groups, mostly from out of town, and the ANC and the EFF supporters in Paris. Actually, very quickly that died away,
yeah.
And the media interest dried up because, you know, this is a country, as you know better than me, that is constantly following the latest incident of this kind of violence, and which finds it very difficult to focus on one story for a long period of time. And this was an exceptionally long investigation and trial. So I had the story pretty much to myself. But it is sad that it didn't gain more prominence. And it is, I think, I particularly noted that, you know, in Tumahole, which is the township outside Paris, people knew almost nothing about what had happened in the trial over the years. And I felt that there was a really lost opportunity there because, you know, these incidents, you know, and they don't define what's going on in these farming communities. I picked on a murder, not on the day-to-day life there. But it felt like this could have been a moment for the community to draw together and to learn and to understand and to swap stories.
Yeah.
And yet that never happened. And that speaks to the decline of local media, the struggle to have good radio stations, good local newspapers that speak in different languages and can tell these tales to a broad range of people. And that I found very frustrating because I felt there was so much in what happened in that courtroom and in these people's lives that could have been useful, that could have been somehow teachable.
And is that not also another South African story that we miss all of these opportunities, these teachability opportunities that, I don't know, life gives us? Is that not a South African story? I mean, so much about South Africa is the great opportunity for the humanization of the people of South Africa, who've been dehumanized, I would argue, by the various laws, the various behaviors, the various issues that arise out of this melting pot of wrongness, right? I mean, some people have even called South Africa a crime scene, yeah? If you look at the various laws that have created this thing called South Africa, there are so many opportunities for us to learn how to be more humane, how to be more human in various contexts. And I find that that has been the general South African story.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I mean, at one level, this book is about the kind of individual relationships and the failures of communication in this very divided community. But at another level, and I think perhaps a more fundamental and more important level, it's about the failure of institutions, because Simon Jubeba and Samuel Chika were let down at every stage by the institutions, the police, the medical teams that should have diagnosed them correctly and treated them correctly and which didn't, and then by the people who carried out their post-mortems, who failed spectacularly and were exposed in court as having failed spectacularly to properly work out what had happened to them. And then by the prosecution team, which also made strange gambles and strange deals and failed to prove their cases in court as a result of those very flawed evidences, by the flawed collection of data, by every aspect that could have brought at least some peace or at least some explanation to their own families who have waited these 5 years wondering, you know, who will pay the price for the death of these two men? And as it turns out, no one will.
You made the comment that you were quite surprised by the fact that this didn't raise the kind of attention that you had expected, that you had perhaps even hoped for a situation where so much injustice had been demonstrated at so many different levels, right? At the levels of the institutions that you have pointed out who have failed these two men, at the level of the media, at the level of, I suppose, the communities that could have taken this issue more seriously.
Know that I want to stand in judgment on these. I mean, I understand, you know, the problems facing, the challenges facing my own colleagues in journalism. There are constantly new, bigger stories. This was, you know, when it boils down to it, this was the death of two men in a country where many more people die every day in equally appalling circumstances. So, I was happy that I had the story journalistically, not quite to myself, but relatively to myself. I don't think my publishers were so happy. I think they would have been delighted if it was more a prominent story. But I just felt, you know, I kept going back to it because it kept twisting and it kept revealing more to me. And it had always been a gamble that I'd attached myself right from the beginning to this particular case, which had no, apart from the sheer fact that it sort of cut against the usual, you know, it was counterintuitive in that normally we hear about white farmers being murdered in their homes in horrific manners by black thieves. And yet this was the opposite. And that was what first, in a way, drew me to it, because I think those counterintuitive stories often can prove extremely revealing. Not that they perhaps constitute the kind of the typical case, but because they don't, they reveal and expose people in different and interesting ways.
What I was going to ask was the general mutedness of that story relative to its deep injustice, to its moment of teachability, to the stories that are multi-layered for humanity. Doesn't that perhaps demonstrate the fact that, yes, when you are close to the story and you're looking at the details of the story, and we'll look at some of those now, that it is a very, very deeply disturbing story. But as you correctly put it, that it is yet another murder of two black men in South Africa, an occurrence that happens all too often. Isn't the fact that the story was rather muted a commentary on the fact that this is such a such a usual thing that happens.
I guess so. Yeah. And what I suppose what strikes me as a journalist is the difficulty of finding the money and the time for people to invest in these longer projects, because Google and Microsoft and all of the rest of them have gobbled up the revenues of these local newspapers and radio stations, the people who need to be telling these longer, complex stories that require money, they require investment, they require journalists to give up a lot of time. I was in a uniquely lucky, privileged position because I could take time off from my day job at the BBC, and I could spend those months just loitering around the court and wandering around the farms and the township and getting to meet and to understand and just to listen and to wallow in these stories. And it's very, very rare that the modern world and the modern world of journalism affords those opportunities. And I was very lucky and just delighted to have that chance to dig deep and deeper. And of course, one could have done this on almost any story, because these murders, when they occur so often, the complexities when they're revealed are so revealing and so important. So I don't hold up this story as being somehow unique and special, but it was the fact that I was able to spend so much time that I think allowed me to dig into all those nuances.
It's easy to look at the story and caricature it, give it a simple narrative, almost a label that just sits it aside and say, oh, that's the South African story, white people, racists, exerting power over two helpless black men. It's a very easy narrative to come with. But you seem to be suggesting that there are nuances, there are complexities there that we don't get to understand if we don't go in the kind of depth that we ought to be going into some of these stories. What are some of those issues, Andrew, that you saw that made you realize that, it's very easy, as I said, to caricature a story, but there's more here?
I'm thinking, as you're speaking there, of Sizwe Mpofu Walsh, who I'm sure you know, a very prominent commentator and academic, who I spoke to a few months ago about this as well. And he said something that I think quite a few people have kind of wanted to articulate, which is that they felt I was being too fair, that I was telling this story from too many sides, and I was humanizing everybody. And Sizwe was going, I wanted you to be more angry. I wanted you to point out this was an outrageous race crime, and that, that was the main point. And my argument, and I really do stick to this, is that that was not my job. I understand that there is a big market in South Africa, rightly, for current affairs books that are driven by opinion.
An accusatory sort of finger, polemic. Yep.
But that's not the book I ever wanted to write. I wanted to write, I mean, maybe I'm getting above my station, but I wanted to write a work of literature where the reader has to do some work and has to, and I think I personally, as a consumer of news and literature, I like it when I'm presented with lots of very human people, and the white farmers in this tale are all very human, and they all have, why were they so angry that afternoon? Why did they storm on these two men, defenseless men, calling them the K word? Why did these youngsters aged 18, 19, 20 repeatedly call them that word and repeatedly assault them to the point of unconsciousness? What were the fears, and what was the history driving that? Is it simplistic just to say they're racist? Of course it is. There's much more going on behind that. That's not to excuse in any way what happened, but I think to understand is the job of people like me, to try to explain, to explore, and for me that supersedes any kind of grandstanding polemic opinion and finger pointing. I don't see that as my role, not certainly not in a book like this. And I find it much more powerful as a reader to be left to draw my own conclusions.
And I think that that's why you won the award. And let me thank you for doing that, because I think we have a serious dearth of the kind of literary works that are not grandstanding, but telling the human story. You see, one of the things that I've discovered is that when somebody performs a gruesome act, it's very easy to dehumanize them, other them than them. And that is because we then give ourselves the opportunity to suggest that those are not human beings. The idea that they may be human beings is scary in that it also points the finger at me and suggests that it is possible that I could do the same thing. And for that reason, many people find the kind of work that you've done with this book very, very uncomfortable, because it humanizes the perpetrator. It does not absolve the perpetrator of the, but it humanizes the perpetrator. And for that reason, I think many of us fear that kind of storytelling, because it suggests that if another human being is able to do this to another human being, so is it perhaps possible for me to be the same kind of perpetrator. So I definitely agree with your take on how you've written and the reasons why you've written the story the way that you've written. I understand why Sizwe and other people might want to see a far more accusatory tone in the way that you've written the book. I understand, because the South African story needs to be told in full. But what is the full South African story? We have, even at the moment, Andrew, other issues that are taking place. I mean, I don't know if you've been watching the story that's developing out in Gqeberha, or the formerly known PE, that's developing now between Somali business owners and taxi drivers. And this story reminds me of this. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
A couple of days ago, yeah.
Yeah. So the question that I wanted to add on to this conversation as we go on is that you also talk about the fact that there are evidence of hyper masculinity and violence, particularly against women, in the story. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is in the book, a lot of it isn't in the book, and it was a tricky path to tread. But what I was very struck by was that although fundamentally this was a story of a group of men in anger, in all sorts of fear and whatever, beating each other up and assaulting each other, which is such a common problem in South Africa, this male violence against men is you know, to be honest, accounts for most of the murders and most of the deaths. But of course, violence against women is an atrocious scourge here. And it was very striking to me that almost all the relationships that I encountered in the course of these years researching involved levels of violence, men against women. There was scarcely a marriage or a relationship I encountered where that wasn't an issue, and so in a way it's the subtext to the book and to what I found there, that level of violence. And what you were talking about there earlier about this idea of South Africa's struggles, but also of what I've seen over the years is of, you know, in war reporting is of the way in which countries can turn and struggle so quickly and lose their way, and I suppose that's influenced me a great deal as well.
You chose to tell the story in a very forgive me for the way I'm going to say this, in a very long-winded way. In that it isn't, in the sense that it is not a report. It isn't a journalistic report. It is a story. And because it's a story, because it takes on the literary dimensions of a novel, it does begin to humanize the perpetrators, which a report perhaps wouldn't, right? Because a report would simply say, white racists kill two helpless black men. Yeah. And it's a very, very easy story for us all to understand. We've seen it all the way from the story of the Tulsa murders. I mean, you know, the story of the Black Wall Street and how that story turned out and how it created all sorts of chaos in the United States, to all of the stories that we've seen movies about the great American South, the South African story of racial division, racial tensions, racial subjugation, economic subjugation as a result of racial issues. These are easy stories that we've all heard of. Is there a part of you, Andrew, that says, while I was humanizing these people from all sides, that I didn't highlight the crime here? Bearing in mind, of course, that this slot is called Crime Time with Aubrey. There was a crime here.
I would argue that I did the opposite. I mean, what I did was I returned in the book repeatedly from every angle and from every perspective to what happened to those men that night. And that was a device that runs right the way through the book, to focus, to centralize that violence, and to show how, from different perspectives, you know, the various people accused saw it, or at least chose to see it, or chose to present it to the court. That actually you have all these fragmented, different kaleidoscopic views of this horrific assault on these two men.
One could be mistaken to even believe that this is a commentary on the psychology of violence. Would you agree?
I suppose so. I mean, why do men, and it's a very South African thing, and this crosses, you know, races and communities. There is an undercurrent of violence, and, you know, I wasn't here during apartheid. I wasn't here in the years after apartheid. So I'm really reflecting on this from a distance. But it does seem to me that there is a culture of violence in South Africa that is very quickly tapped into. And there is also, you know, there are complexities around these cases. For instance, while I was researching this case, the Coligny Sunflower murders happened.
Yes.
And I'm sure you'll remember that. And
yep.
That was, to me, a very different story and very interesting, but of course, even more politicized than this one, because of course, two men were arrested. They were found guilty on the evidence of one man who was found to be later entirely unreliable, and any judge, any court would have thrown his evidence out as worthless. And it took years and an appeal to a higher court for that simple fact to have been revealed. So that was in many ways a highly, much more political and much more controversial case. And clearly showed the kind of the gap between what people might want to wish in terms of justice and the importance of simply following the facts and trying to keep politics out of the courtroom.
Who did you write this story for, Andrew?
I wrote it for myself, I suppose, firstly. I wrote it, and this is, I suppose, where I'm getting probably wildly ambitious ahead of myself, but my ideal was that this somehow could be presented to the communities around Padays and all the different people. You know, I just remember standing outside the hospital once in Padays, and I'd been talking to people inside about what had happened to Simon and Samuel that night, and I was chatting to a group of ambulance drivers, and they were so thirsty knowledge about this case, because everyone knew a little bit about it, but then it had disappeared from the newspapers, from the radio. They just didn't know what had happened. So much hunger to know what had happened. And I suppose, in a way, I wrote it for those ambulance drivers and for all the people I encountered in Tumahole in particular, but also in Paris, because I wanted, you know, I had to mingle with all sorts of different people, people who obviously found my presence there quite upsetting. You know, who is this Englishman coming in to a very complicated, you know, tragic, tortured situation, community? Who's this Englishman who doesn't speak Afrikaans, doesn't speak Sesotho, trying to understand this? And I think there's a lot of skepticism about me, a lot of hostility. But I want to kind of show to these people that I was taking their versions seriously, and that, that those versions are in the book, even though I think, you know, something of what I feel and believe about shines through. My aim was not to make that prominent, but I would hope, ideally, that, you know, if people were given the chance to read the book, that they would perhaps learn a little bit more about what it looks like from the other side of the fence, from the other side of the field, from Tumahole rather than Paris, and from Paris rather than Tumahole.
Did you not get a sense that this is a continuation of an unreconciled community? In other words, that this act of violence, this particular crime, is indicative of the fact that blacks and whites in South Africa are yet to see each other as human beings rather than as blacks and whites?
You know, that's such a difficult question. When I first started investigating this story, the one thing that put me off was that I didn't want to write a book about the kind of extremes of South Africa, because there was a danger that we fanned the flames of these kind of extreme versions of this country, which, you know, certain political parties do for their own benefit, and which certain communities do. And I've always been skeptical about that, because the South Africa that I've come to a little bit about in 12 years.
Oh, Andrew, I'm losing you. I'm losing
more
you
forgiving,
again.
Forgiving, much more tolerant.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead. Let's go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was saying that the South Africa that I've learned to know over the last 12 years is much more tolerant and conservative and respectful of different communities and different races than I think sometimes get portrayed in the media, certainly on social media, you know, that cesspit so often of division. And I was wary about this story because I felt that it could pull to the extremes, that, you know, this was the group outside the court, some screaming white genocide, others screaming, you know, racist killers. And clearly, that, you know, there's an element of all of that. But I wanted to write a book that got into the nuance of people and why they were scared, why they were frustrated. So I am not convinced that South Africa is as sort of racially intolerant as I suppose this book in some ways reflects. I think there's still an awful lot of compassion and forgiveness and tolerance that is sometimes ignored.
Did you, I mean, somebody might argue that you write the book from a particular internal disposition, and that is wanting to perhaps highlight the untold South African story of tolerance, of compassion, versus the much highlighted story of polarization, hate, fear, and all of those kinds of things. But did you, at the end of your journey, whether it was the investigation, the writing of the story, get to a sense that as much as there are elements, strong elements of that compassion, of that humanity, but that the fear, the deep-seated racism, the victimhood, the all of that stuff is still an issue to be concerned about?
Yeah, I don't think I came at it with a particularly kind of sunny disposition. I saw this for what it was, a story about a horrific, you know, what I would say as a racist crime.
Yeah.
And I wanted to explore why that was. But I do think that these fundamentally need to be seen through an institutional lens, because I think that's how you fix things and that's how you address things. Sure, individuals can say horrible things and they can be horrific racists and they can be violent, but it is fundamentally the institutions that will save or condemn South Africa. And while those institutions are built by individuals, they are fundamental to, you know, to law and order, to you know, to what we've seen now in the fight against state capture. I mean, these are very fundamental things. And there's a real sense I got in Paris and I've got in many other communities that those things are collapsing. They're breaking down. And I find it more useful to view the fight to save South Africa through that lens rather than running around and branding people as individuals. And particularly, and this is obviously, as I say, it's a special case. You pick a murder or an alleged murder or a murder investigation because you're looking for drama. And hopefully through that prism, you can also dig deeper in a book and try and understand stuff that lurks behind that. So this is about individuals, but it is also, as I say, about the institutions.
Well, this is some of the these are some of the words that were given by some South Africans who read this book. Justice Malala says he says that it should be read not just by South Africans but far and wide by those who wish to understand truth and reconciliation, fear and redemption, and those who love a masterful story. And I'm going to leave it there, Andrew, and say thank you for writing this book in the way that you've written it. Because indeed, you could have chosen the route of grandstanding, but you've written the book in a way that is very, very challenging to all of us who seek truth, and who have been bombarded, I suppose, by caricatured narratives. You have taken the very brave, very uncharted ground of actually saying, can you believe that human beings can do this to each other? And I think that is the question that all South Africans need to ask themselves, because it's so easy to say, oh, the white people, they're not human, or oh, the black people are not human. But what you've done with this story is to say that look at what human beings can do with each other. And that, in my opinion, is very, very brave. And thank you for having written the book. The book is called These Are Not Gentle People by Andrew Harding. And Andrew, thank you so much for just honoring us with your presence. And once again, congratulations for the award.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on your terrific show. I really appreciate it.
Much appreciated.